My Skype made a funny noise before it made the dialing noise.
Oh. Like funny haha?
Like a bloop bloop, a bloop bloop.
Oh.
Not sure what that was all about.
I don't know. It's been a long time since I've called somebody.
You like being the callee, not the caller?
I do. I do. It's a nice little thing.
You let Scott call you for your random trekking?
Yeah, because it's his show. In a very literal sense.
Good show. I listened. I didn't understand any of it.
Yeah, that's fine. It's okay. That wasn't really like a good episode of Deep Space Nine, so I wouldn't really recommend you go watch it. But yeah, I like talking to him, so it's fun.
Yeah, he's good. All that stuff about being sad about an award show somehow made it into an episode. That's weird.
Yeah, it's very strange. It was it because they usually have like an A and a B plot on Star Trek, so that they can make the most use out of the number of characters that they have on in the ensemble cast. But and sometimes they even have this, like a C story. But this was a particularly weak B story, so that was just sad to sit through. The A story wasn't great either, but nothing compared to how sad the B story was.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the Ferengi are the ones with the ears.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
You said a name and I think I kind of sort of pictured the one it was, but I don't watch that show.
Yeah, no, it's okay. That's fine. Although that show has one of my favorite Star Trek characters, well, a lot of my favorite Star Trek characters, but one of them in particular is Garak, who is somewhat pragmatic, untrustworthy, maybe former spy slash tailor, who
Wait,
yeah.
spy slash Taylor?
Well, when you first meet him, he's introduced as a tailor, and he kind of seems to know a little bit more than like a tailor would. Also, he's been exiled from Cardassia, and he's a Cardassian, so it seems like maybe, he did something bad. And then you kind of start piecing together over the course of the series that, oh, he's a spy who a former spy, and he does spy stuff, so it's
So
fun.
he's like a Kingsman. He's a pretend tailor, but he's a spy.
Yeah, Tinker, Taylor, Soldier Spy.
No, not that. The other one. They were tailors.
Oh, they were?
Yeah.
Huh. I wonder where they got that from.
You should go see that movie. It's good. I mean,
Oh.
not really go see that movie because it's not really like a place to go to see it.
I wish I knew somebody that worked on it.
Yeah, all of those residuals. You'd really
Yeah.
help them out.
So grumpy. But yeah, that was Andrew Robinson, who plays Garak in that show, and I kept thinking about him when I was watching Cobra, because he's in it and he's kind of wasted in it, because he just kind of shows up and he's just like, yeah, you don't play by the rules. I don't like people who don't play by the rules. And it's like, no hard feelings, and then punch in the face.
You wouldn't hit a guy with glasses, would you? Even if I'm making fun of you while I'm saying no hard feelings.
It's so awful. This movie is just atrocious.
Yeah, so it happened in between the Beverly Hills Cops, and I can see kind of why they would have maybe wanted to poke fun at it in Beverly Hills Cop 2 with the poster on the wall, because as you read in that Wikipedia thingamabob, the name Cabretti was going to be Axel Foley's last name if Stallone played the character, which would have been dreadful. He probably would have wanted to go by Cobra in that movie. I mean, Cobra would have been Beverly Hills Cop if not for I don't know what rational people or Eddie Murphy or whatever series of events led them to throw out whatever Stallone wrote in favor of Eddie Murphy. Thank goodness, because this movie is I mean, aside from being bad, it's what, like 1.5 acts just sort of stretched out over 1 hour and 27 minutes? Like, it doesn't. I can't. There were times where I kind of forgot I was watching a movie.
It's pretty amazing that there is even a screenplay to this, and it is, of course, by Sylvester Stallone. Because there's not a lot of dialogue or character or people even saying each other's names other than the main character over and over and over again. So there was a couple points in the film where I was just like, is that person who is on the screen? They've been talking for a long time, but I don't even remember. Did they say his name and I just forgot? Oh, well. So it's very weird. Like, his buddy with the hat. I know they said his name. I have no idea what it is. I couldn't tell you.
It's Gonzalez. It's Sergeant Tony Gonzalez.
Oh, okay.
From Seinfeld. And like, who was in Seinfeld, right?
And who was Andrew Robinson? Like, I don't even remember the name of him.
He is Detective Monty. I don't think they said his name.
Oh, no, they did. Now that you said Monty, I remember. He's like, I'm going to punch Monty. You know.
Right. Yeah. We'll punch a hole in his chest or whatever, because he makes me so angry. But it's just great. Like, you know, he's got his little buddy with the newsboy hat there, and just they're strolling around. He's always eating something, and Stallone's always got his matchstick that he's chewing on, which is a peculiar affectation for a character, but all right.
Well, he's not in favor of smoking. He's against smoking, so he just chooses his matchstick thing.
I like how he's such a tough guy, you know, down there in Venice Beach, that he'll like ram a car out of the way to get a good spot, and then like tear the guy's shirt off of his chest when the guy's like, "Why did you hit my car?" He's a really great cop.
Ah, man, this movie is just like bizarre. Like, I don't understand. Like, it takes itself so seriously, even in those little moments like that, where it's just like, this is absurd. Like, if this happened in real life, like, you wouldn't be able to continue with the film. It would be like, nope, we're done. And it's not a comedy like Beverly Hills Cop, where you could play it off and be like, oh, that Axel Foley, you know, this is a comedy movie. He does his wacky stuff. No,
there are a couple of jokes in here which don't land at all because they make no sense.
Yeah, well, you know, he's got an attitude problem. A little wood, and then he makes like a little tiny gesture with his index finger and his thumb.
There was another one earlier, like at the end of the scene where they're hanging out at the doctor, where it kind of looked like a morgue, where they're like eating Brigitte Nielsen's food or whatever, because she's like traumatized and she doesn't want the food. And they're like, you're done with this, right? And then they, like, him and his buddy start sharing her sandwich, which I think was supposed to be funny, but it wasn't funny. It was just weird.
Yeah. Well, there's some unintentional funny parts in here. Like when they're at the morgue after the first stabbing, and Stallone is just picking up some sort of metal forceps thing. I don't know what that is. And he's just like playing with it and staring at it intently. And it's just like, oh, okay. So you wanted to have some business with the props, but
you wanted to play with the bone saw. I wanted a nurse to come over and snatch it out of his hands and be like, we have to wash that again now. Thank you.
Yeah, well, it didn't seem to matter because they were also smoking in the morgue.
Well, I mean, the body's already dead. What are you going to do? We're not going to taint the evidence or anything like that.
I suppose not. No, it is. This movie is just weird because it's so serious, but at the same time, you can't take it seriously because it's just bananas.
Yeah, it's like, it's not even like they wrote a series of scenes. It's like they wrote a couple of like bullet points about some stuff that would be super badass for a character to do in a movie. And they're like, well, where can we take this character thing and stick it? It's like, well, okay, he's got a super cool gun, and we'll do a gun putting together montage with lasers and stuff. And then we could use the laser to like trick somebody because they think they see the laser, but he's really hiding somewhere else. And then there's like, you know, I've seen a couple of these shots before, because there was that like 80s action movie montage thing that was just set to like some techno music that was going around on Vimeo for a while, and I really liked it. But the part where he like grabs the cigarette out of the guy's face, and then, you know, the part where he like smashes the car from the top of the second story of the parking deck and the car chase, and it's like, out of context, those are kind of like some cool like badass cop kind of moves, but then everything else around it is just like, there's nothing there. Like he when he's walking around his apartment or whatever, and he throws the newspaper in the Weber grill, and he's just kind of like strolling, he just looks sad and lost and confused, but not like in like a, the character is kind of lonely and sad, which apparently he is, because he eats like half a slice of pizza a day, and he makes sure he portions it out with his pair of scissors.
It wasn't even half.
He didn't even cut it the right way. He cut it through the middle.
He cut the tip of a slice of pizza off. So we had a very tiny, tiny little like micro slice of pizza without a crust.
Maybe he wanted to pretend he was a giant and he had like a little tiny piece of pizza in his hand.
Yeah, well, he does seem to have some issues with his confidence level. I should assume just by our opening montage with the extreme close-ups on his gun with the cobra on it. What is that? It's not the holster, the butt of the gun. What is that?
The grip or whatever.
Yeah, so he's got a grip, and it's got a painted cobra on it, and there are several extreme close-ups on it in the course of the film, because that's how you know you're watching the movie Cobra, because you saw a picture of one. And
yeah, they call him in like he's a SWAT team, like, yeah, call the big jerk, yeah, he'll take care of for us or whatever. But he's just a dude who just likes to shoot people.
Yeah.
And they kind of, you know, I guess if you want to like retcon it, the whole like loneliness, lack of confidence thing kind of comes back into play later when they reveal that his name is Marion Cabretti. And it's like, oh, I got beat up when I was little because I got a stupid name. And it's like that whole scene was just nonsense. But I assume that's kind of what they were going for, maybe. Like he's hard on the outside, but he's really lovable on the inside because he's just a nerd who got beat up when he was a kid or something because he had a goofy name.
It doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense.
No, that's why he goes around sort of just randomly murdering people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
doesn't play by the rules because the bullies on the playground didn't play by the rules back then. I don't know. You got Marion Cabretti, you got Ingrid Knudsen, played by Brigitte Nielsen.
I looked it up. They were actually married in this.
Yeah.
And before this was released, they were married in 85, and this was released in 86. So maybe during the course of production, they got married.
Did you happen to notice what she was doing around 87?
Yeah, well, Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Yeah, and the director.
Oh,
apparently she had a fling with Tony Scott at the end of that whole thing there.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't research this either, but this is what I was being told by the person sitting next to me on the couch looking at Wikipedia.
Oh, well.
So I mean, you know,
thank our research department.
Yes, thank my wife, our research department, for looking up who was dating who. She's very good at that sort of knowledge.
Yeah. Interesting.
Which is weird though, because I think Tony Scott is like 20 years older than her.
Well, it's also extremely weird. With the, because after seeing this film and knowing some of these details, it makes the minor poster in Beverly Hills Cop 2 all the more bizarre, and it makes me question, like, what was the motivation in casting Brigitte Nielsen exactly? Because it seems so strange, because it's just like, were they doing this to, like, tweak Stallone because, you know, they didn't like him or something? Or I don't understand, because they have the Cobra poster in Rosewood's room in Beverly Hills Cop 2. As you noticed, I'd never actually pieced it together because I didn't really, well, care. But yeah,
it's a pretty dope poster. But yeah, other than that,
yeah. Well, the poster might be the best thing about this movie. But then there's Brigitte Nielsen, who's cast in the film, and this was a film that Eddie Murphy has, which was based on what her husband at the time, I guess, had been rejected from, and had made his own movie based on ideas that he had when he was in the planning stages of what he was going to do with Beverly Hills Cop. So it's really weird. Oh, I didn't mention that before, but this was apparently an extension of his ideas that he didn't end up using in Beverly Hills Cop.
Totally, yeah. I mean, he took the name, so you kind of assume a lot of this stuff would have been in that script. But, I would really like to see the exact timeline of, like, shooting dates and then, like, script drafts being delivered and, you know, when they turned Stallone down and all that stuff, just to see, like, and then when Brigitte was doing her things with whom, because, you know, it does feel kind of like a jab at Stallone, specifically because, I mean, it's in Rosewood's room, and Rosewood is very clearly being portrayed as kind of a nut job in the movie and, you know, kind of overly into the firearms, and everyone's just sort of rolling their eyes at him and wondering about his mental stability.
Yeah.
So I think it's pretty safe to say that everyone who worked on Beverly Hills Cop 2 was kind of laughing at Stallone, and probably mostly laughing at Cobra, because they probably all didn't have access to the Beverly Hills Cop 1 draft that he wrote, hopefully.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's an interesting character. Like, even in regards to Cobra, it's allegedly based on a novel, Fair Game, which was supposed to be the source material. Of course, like we said, it was these other ideas. But when the film came out, Stallone, according to Wikipedia, allegedly wanted the novel to be reissued with himself credited as co-author. Ms. Gosling declined the offer.
What? He took the source material and then made a movie based on it, and then wanted the source material to then credit him for the source?
Apparently?
That's not how that works.
Yeah, also this was apparently heavily re-edited by Warner Brothers in post-production.
Oh, I believe that for sure, because there's nothing here. There's, like, whether they were trying to, like, further flesh out the characters or whatever, or add some sort of depth to them, the whole, like, scenes of them driving away and, like, hiding out of town, and then the brief romantic interaction that is just completely useless and unnecessary because we don't feel anything for any of these characters, like, that goes on for a really long time, and it just really feels like they were missing something. Like, I can't even describe it in a way other than to say, like, there's a first act and then, like, a little bit of a second act, and then it just kind of ends and they ride away on a motorcycle, and not even like a good, like, riding off into the sunset shot. Like, it's a like a crane shot, and they're riding at the camera, and then they get really close to the camera, and then they just kind of go to the side and it's over.
Where did they get that motorcycle from, by the way?
It had to be from one of the bad guys who rolled up with the
yeah, but wouldn't
the Axe Gang, and he just, like, took it.
Yeah, because wouldn't that be evidence?
I mean, you know, the guy's dead.
Well, I know that, but still, like, evidence.
Technically, yes, but it's just going to go to auction because they're not going to learn anything about the guy, you know. You know, Zed's dead, baby, and then they take his chopper.
Yeah, you know, he's not exactly a great cop because that was right after he punched a superior officer. But the...
Is a superior sergeant? Detective Monty and then Lieutenant Cobra.
Oh.
I don't know how ranks work. Is that higher or lower?
I don't know. Well, he kept telling him what to do, and, like, you better watch yourself, Cabretti, and blah blah blah. I'm not gonna clean up after this stuff, like, so I don't know. Maybe Stallone just didn't know what the ranks really were. So
well, yeah. I mean, once the New World Order comes into play, all ranks are going to be turned upside down.
Oh, my God, the New World Order. Jesus Christ.
Which apparently involves people in an abandoned church clinking double-sided axes together.
That's one of the... Just like when you're watching the opening to this movie, and it's just red sky, motorcycle, Stallone riding on it, and never mind that the motorcycle really doesn't come into play at any part for him, because
that was even him. Wasn't that the guy who rides up to the grocery store because he parks in the handicap spot? The crazy guy in the opening scene. He was on the motorcycle, wasn't he? Because I thought there was, like, a close-up of the tattoo wrist, which is a thing that they kept doing, like, oh, this is a bad guy.
Well, it had the voiceover for Stallone where he's like, there are this many murders, there are this many, et cetera.
And, oh, yeah, the crime statistics. That's good.
That's what you really tune into your opening credits for, is crime statistics.
But it was also intercut with those shots where he was like pointing the gun straight at the camera, and then the really bad, like, bullet coming out thing.
Yeah, like it was a James Bond movie. And they've got the close up on the Cobra, and they're cutting between all of these various things, and they're cutting to, like you said, those people who are clanging axes together for no reason. And for the longest time in the movie, that doesn't get explained. And even though we see people from that group later, presumably those people, they're the ones who show up at the end. It's just like, why did they do any of this? It doesn't make any sense. Like, they don't address this whole New World Order thing, and it's like, oh, they're all following the murderer guy, and it's just like, well, but are they? Is he leading them with the thing? Like, what are they technically hoping to accomplish here with the because there's the Night Slasher, who's played by Brian Thompson. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, Brian Thompson and
Buffalo Bob from Joe Dirt,
and numerous Star Trek roles. He played a Klingon twice, and
did he even wear any makeup?
Yeah. What was funny though is when he showed up as a Romulan, because Romulans aren't like really like big and bulky, but he's like the angriest, bulkiest Romulan you've ever seen. He also has like the mouth, very distinctive feature, but you know, listeners to this program might recognize him first and foremost for his most notable role as Shao Kahn in Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
I saw that on his credits, but I didn't want to bring it up. I'm scrolling through trying to find. Wait, is that the photo of it? He's got kind of like a metal vest thing on, short hair. No, I don't think that's it. Anyway, yeah, he's got a very peculiar look about him. I'm surprised he didn't play more bad guys and things.
He played a lot of them.
Apparently he played a bad guy in Moonlighting with Bruce Willis.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do? But,
oh my god.
Yeah,
it was in a movie called The Expendables, which looks like just like an Asylum ripoff of The Expendables.
Oh.
Oh dear.
No, okay. No loyalty to Stallone?
No, of course. I mean, if Stallone would have put him in there, I'm sure he would have been all about it, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, that Mortal Kombat money is not going to keep things going for much longer. No, but there's nothing about the organization of the Night Slasher with his informant who works inside the police department with these other people who have motorcycles and axes, and with the grocery store guy who seems to be associated with them on some level, because they don't like,
or at least he's a fan of them.
Yeah. Huge fan of your work. No, but they don't like tie it together in any coherent way. Like, it's not like, oh, and this is all part of our plan to do X. It's like, no, he's just like slashing people. And so they're talking about the New World Order. And it's like, what is that exactly? Because you just,
I think if it's anything, it's just anarchy. They're just basically saying, like, you know, the world has devolved to garbage. So we're just going to kill whoever we want, whenever we want. Because, you know, according to that news broadcast, the Night Slasher is indiscriminate who he kills, old people, young people, men, women, whatever. And then we proceed to watch him just slash a bunch of women, which doesn't super jive with the thing we just heard.
No, and they all coincidentally happen to look very similar and be sort of model-esque, shall we say. Like, even the waitress who's leaving the, like, coffee shop diner that's underneath the freeway overpass. it's just like, okay, so, like, maybe she's trying to make it big in Hollywood and she's an actress and this was, like, you know, a shift that she was going to work or something. Because I can't really picture her being like a career waitress at the diner underneath the overpass. But, you know, people fall in hard times. So who am I to judge?
I mean, she was the last to lock up. Maybe it was her diner under the overpass.
Could have been. She got it from her father.
Family business.
There's so much of this stuff in here that is just like, especially with the timeline, though, of the Night Slasher. Because, like, there's that, and then there's another murder that's happening, and it appears to be Spring Street in downtown Los Angeles, which has an upper Spring Street level and a lower Spring Street level. I don't know if you've ever been there, but...
I don't think so.
Yeah, well, that street is basically a dead end because it goes into the underground parking for where the Walt Disney Concert Hall is now. I have no idea what used to be there. Maybe it was a different parking garage. Maybe it went nowhere. Brigitte Nielsen is driving around on Spring Street there for no apparent reason and spots the other murder happening, who at first I wasn't sure if it was supposed to be the same person, but they had like dragged her there. But then they're cross-cutting with like the morgue scene, and it's just like, okay, so maybe this is like a second lady who has died so far in this after the coffee lady. So It's just very confusing. Yeah. And they you know, have the team all working together, breathing hard through their pantyhose. So,
I mean, he does have that creepy look because he's got his nose all squished down. He should have gone, like, one size up in his pantyhose or whatever. It would have been more comfortable for him. But, I mean, aside from the...
You know how those muscly people are. They like to wear something just, like, a little too small.
It shows off how hard they've been working. Yeah, I mean, what's the point if you don't flaunt it a little bit?
Yeah, you gotta show off how hard you've been working on your jaw. I don't know.
It's beach season for your jaw. But, like, aside from the lack of clarity on what this New World Order is, it seems to just be that they're just gonna go around killing people for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
So would you say they're using order ironically?
I guess, but then, like, on top of this, they're kind of like, you know, at the end there, kind of the crux of it all is he's poking fun at Stallone, saying, you know, you're a cop and you follow all these rules and haha, you know, you're constrained by the law and stuff, and we're not because we're anarchists or whatever. And he does his little, you know, what did he say? This is where the law stops and I start, which is a stupid line. But then he doesn't even follow through on it because the lady comes up behind him or whatever. But, like... You can't have it both way, guy. You're either all in on anarchy or you're just sort of like, you know, trying to be the Joker and break it down or something. But he's just like, we do what we want, and then you can go ahead and arrest me. Like, you know, go ahead and try and take my knife from me. See what you got. Which, I mean, there's none of that was even remotely believable because Brian Thompson's way bigger than Stallone.
Yeah.
He would have just stabbed him the first time, like, right in the neck because it's, like, right at blade level.
Well, it's also a weird scene because he's like... You won't kill me because you're a cop and cops don't kill people. It's like, dude, I know you have the informant lady who is inside the police department. There is no way that she did not tell you that this guy just basically straight up murders everybody. So
I mean, also the fact that you're trying to kill him. If there was ever a moment where a cop would kill you, it would be right then.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, you have to take me in alive. It's like, you know, as sad as it is sometimes in real life, that maybe extreme force is used in the world of this film, it seems like it is perfectly logical that extreme force would be used by this point in the film. So it's not even like, as the audience member, you're not like, oh no, is he going to take him in alive? You're like, no, he's going to straight up murder this guy. Like, there's, and not only that, but no one's going to feel bad that he did, because he's such an obvious jerk that it's not even like remotely questionable. Like, there are no gray areas or facets to any of these villains. They're just one-dimensional jerk faces. And you know, so Brian Thompson, he gets hooked on his little thing and then goes over to the smelting furnace that's in the seaside town.
So, like, you know, as you said, if he were to, like, you know, throw down his weapon and surrender, like, maybe he would be like, oh, I guess I should take him in instead of fight him to the death or whatever. But he's like, you know, come at me, I still got my knife, I'm gonna kill you. But so, like, geography and stuff, how does it work? So they're in the middle of nowhere at their little cottages, and then they, like, try to flee, and then they're, like, in the middle of an orange grove while they're running from the sniper, and then they run out of the orange grove directly into a seaside smelting plant. Which,
that's my favorite part, because
I mean, maybe they're growing iron oranges or something, and they're like, just they're orange colored balls of copper or something that they're going to melt down. I don't know. But yeah, those aren't things that are near each other.
No. Well, see, it could, because it wasn't like right on the beach, that little town, but it was basically a beachside town. Like, they had these shots establishing that the water was somewhat nearby. Not only water, but, you know, like, railroad tracks and all kinds of other things. And, they have the small little diners and stuff, and the little hotels, and probably motels, because they looked like they were from the 50s. And they have the smelting plant, and it's just like, I don't understand how any of these things go together. And it seems oddly industrial for this area to have the smelting plant. And not only a smelting plant, but an automated smelting plant.
Sure. They basically needed to get from sort of like a lighter environment where they could have their love scene to, like, right into downtown RoboCop in like 5 minutes. So how do you do that? And it's just, you drive down the street a little bit and then you roll your car because you had to drive through the center of some flaming, well, those semis or other trucks of some sort.
They just look like they were cars that they set on fire, but they're like the 1970s cars where it's just like solid steel. So
sure, right, whatever. And then suddenly they're in an orange grove, and then a big, big, like, Terminator 2 factory.
Yeah.
At least nobody got squished by any equipment. Like, they were very dramatic with the hanging him from a hook that then just, like, sort of slides through a closet of fire and burns him to death. Like, I mean,
it doesn't even burn him to death. We dissolve from him going towards the like little U-shaped thing with the flames to just a wall of fire is the next image it dissolves to. And it's just like, you guys, like, really, like, I don't understand. Like, I can understand, like, you didn't want to show the graphic nature of him dying, but just like cutting to, I photographed a wall of fire. It is a little weird, because why? You didn't need to. You could go do anything else you wanted.
Yeah, yeah. There were a lot of instances of lack of production value issues, kind of like that, because, you know, it's very easy to see why the Beverly Hills Cop folks would have said his ideas were too expensive, because you look at this and you're like, wow, that's expensive, and it still looks stupid because you couldn't do any of the other stuff. Like, when he's standing up in the back of the truck fleeing and he's shooting all the guys, it's really just like shot of him, shot of somebody sliding a motorcycle, shot of him, shot of somebody sliding a motorcycle. It's like none of these were intended to go together. You're just like, he stood in the back of the truck and sprayed a fake futuristic machine gun at people, and then you just had a bunch of stunt guys on motorcycles just slide them out into the road.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah,
action scene by the numbers. Action scene.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of this that seems by the numbers. So I suppose we should probably talk about the director.
Oh yeah, who directed this?
George P. Cosmatos.
Sure, who's that?
He is an Greek-Italian film director. And he has directed a number of things. Most notably, immediately before this, the year before this, was Rambo First Blood Part 2.
There was a First Blood Part 2?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then he did Cobra. And then in 1989, he did Leviathan, which is a god-awful alien ripoff. And then in 1993, he did Tombstone, which I actually kind of like. And then,
oh, Tombstone's good.
Yeah, his last movie was Shadow Conspiracy in 97. I have never seen nor heard of that. But, you know, he's done some stuff. Apparently, though, he was mainly more of a producer on this, and that Stallone was calling a lot of the directorial shots, supposedly, behind the scenes.
Yeah. I can believe that, because it's nonsense.
Yeah, because supposedly they were falling behind, and the cinematographer, Rick Waite, told Stallone to stop messing around because he was screwing everything up. And so, you know, that's where that source comes from. So maybe there's a little bit of bias, but... yeah.
Well, the cinematography was very good in the opening scene there, because, you know, how great was it that he was sneaking around the grocery store, and then he hops over to that one wall to use the radio to talk trash to the shotgun guy, and then there just happens to be that red slash of light right over his face while he's doing his little dramatic speech into the microphone. You're a bad shot, and I don't like bad shots.
It's weird.
It's not good.
No. And what was up with was there like some sort of a diffusion filter, or was it just like crummy glass or something? Like, what did they do in the grocery store that like blew out the lights like that?
It's hard to tell, because, I mean, there is that one part where, like, Stallone just enters the grocery store and then all the lights are off all of a sudden. So I kind of feel like they just did whatever they had to do. Although I should check what they shot this with, because there were a lot of extreme close-ups of Stallone where, like, not only did it look like only one of his eyes was in focus because it was rarely narrowed up field, but it looked like the lens was like coming out of its mount or something, because like the separation and the defocus on the edge was like really kind of odd, like it was broken.
Yeah, well, that's why I was wondering if it was like cheap glass or something like that, because it didn't seem to make a tremendous amount of like you're looking at like some of the produce lights and stuff that are on, even though the overhead lights in the grocery store are out, and they're just like blown out and bleeding this like diffusion effect over everything, but like he's crystal clear and doesn't really seem like that should be the case unless there's something really messed up with the glass, because I can't think of any sort of like post process they would have done in 1986 to do that. So, 1985.
I don't know what Cook Veritol lenses are, but apparently they used those in addition to some Panavision stuff. I've never heard of these. I use Cook lenses all the time. I don't know what Veritol, Varotol, V-A-R-O-T-A-L.
Sure.
Huh. Well, it was all spherical, so there shouldn't have been any weird anamorphic stuff messing with it.
It didn't look anamorphic at any point. It was just like very strange. It had a unique look that I don't recall seeing recently.
There were also some incredibly long lenses. Like there were points where they were on, I don't know, like 140, 200 mil lenses, and it's just like, why are you shooting it this way? I don't understand what you're doing here.
Yeah, well, also, there was not a tremendous amount of room that he was leaving in his framing. Everything was a little tighter than I would have preferred something to be framed. And so basically, like, even when you're just having two characters talking to one another, it's maybe you get both of the eyebrows in and an ear, and that's the... It was very weird. Like, I don't know. It was just too tight.
And then it moves in closer at some points, too. Like,
yeah.
When he goes home and eats his half a triangle of pizza and cleans his gun with the stuff that he keeps in a styrofoam egg case on his desk there. There's just, he's watching the news on his crappy little TV, and it just, like, slowly pushes in when there's the dramatic announcement that the Night Slasher killed somebody else.
Yeah. Because he's a cop and he gets all of his information from cable TV. Because he's on the zombie squad. He's not really welcome with the other cops.
Zombie squad. Yeah. I can't tell if that's like the slang or they actually call it that.
I couldn't tell you. This movie seems to be like The Net, but instead of computers, it's cops. And so it's just like one of those things where it's just like
comparison.
Yeah, it's just like, this sort of seems like what maybe somebody thinks being a cop is like, I guess, but it doesn't really seem that way. And I've seen better depictions of all of these things before. And not just by the standards of, you know, today, but in 1985, this seems absurd.
Yeah, not an ounce of it makes sense.
Yeah.
It looks like it was also shot with some super speeds and ultra speeds, which some of the newer versions of super speeds are still around now. They're real fast lenses, like 1.3, but like only the center of the glass is in focus. Everything else is just kind of like messy, gross, blurry, dirty looking crap. So the versions before that are the ones they use. So I guess that could have something to do with it. Just, you know, some glass glued together.
Mm-hmm.
$25 million, though. I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to get some real lenses?
Yeah.
Isn't that like $10 million more than Beverly Hills Cop? Wasn't it like 14 or 13?
Yeah. It was, I think it was 13 for the first one and like 18 for the sequel, or I want to say. I mean, listeners to this program will know that we've said both of these numbers before, but I don't remember them off the top of my head. So anyway, price difference. I imagine some of that has to do with your talent that is billing. But, you know, the box office was $160 million, so it's still quite an investment.
I mean, you had that cool car, the awesome 50. You got all the explosions of the semis. What scene was it where they drive the car past the semi trucks and then shoot back at them to blow them up, try and distract the bad guys?
Wasn't that the chase when they're leaving the police headquarters to go to somewhere safe, and his buddy's in his car and he's in his awesome 50 or whatever with her?
Well, that was after the attempted assassination at the hospital, where somebody at headquarters, quote unquote headquarters, called Sergeant Gonzalez away while Cobra was comparing things against his files at home. That made me laugh so much. I'm gonna go compare these against my files at home, because, you know, he keeps a record of all the scumbags around town because he's that kind of guy. But calls and he's like, headquarters told me to meet you at the morgue. I don't know what's going on here. But then, Brigitte manages to slip away from Buffalo Bob or whatever. And then as soon as they leave the hospital, there's the car chase where Sergeant Tony gets, creamed by a truck, and then they chase and stuff, and it's really, really bad.
It goes on forever. Also,
it goes on forever.
My favorite thing about that, though, is the cut where we go from downtown Los Angeles to the canals of Venice. And they're driving over the little canal bridges, and it's just like, you can't even like mask that. Like you went like a short distance. Like you went on a 45-minute drive here to go to Venice, and I guess that chase was going on the whole entire time. Maybe the magic of editing compressed the time.
There's like another cut, like where they're in like Long Beach or something, and then they cut again, and then they're like back in central Los Angeles. It's like,
oh yeah,
they had like three corners that they were allowed to shoot in the entire city, and they were super far apart. Like, well, I guess we got to do the alley scene in downtown, and then we'll cut to Venice.
Yeah, the Long Beach thing really cracked me up too, because like you'd have to go back to the freeway and then go down to go to Long Beach to go to the port of Los Angeles, because there's all the port stuff that's there. That's not Venice. It's so weird. I don't understand like why they even bothered, because it's just like, does this add anything to the story? Is it adding like atmosphere or ambiance or anything? It's like, no, they're just driving.
He just wanted to, he wrote his little snippets of what would be the cool thing to do, and like jumping his 50 Chevy or whatever over the things in Venice would be a cool shot where they're flying up in the air. I love how they do that. They go over the little bridge, and then they do it in slow motion again. And it's like, well, that's the only part of Venice we were cleared to shoot in, so let's cut to somewhere else. Because like it's literally one shot from two angles, and then in slow mo, and then it's like, well, we got to go somewhere else now because we can't do anything else here. Also, because the speed limit of that part of Venice is what, like 5.
I mean, I don't even know if it's like the limit as much as that's what you could go. Like, yeah, if you were in your car. You really wouldn't want to go faster than that, but because there are some like weird blind corners and stuff that are in Venice, but
they're all like one way streets down there by the canals, aren't they?
Yeah, they're usually one way streets, and also they'll have intersections where several different tiny roads somehow coalesce into like these weird sort of like non-perpendicular intersections. Like I can't explain exactly how they decided to lay this out, but you'll be there and you'll be like, is that a street or an alley? And it'll be like, well, that's a street, but it looks like an alley, and it's wide enough for a car. Mm-hmm. Is there a one-way sign? Yes, there is. Okay, so maybe it is a street, and maybe I won't just be driving down into somebody's driveway. But it's Venice is strange. I don't like it. No.
As somebody who one time many years ago attempted to park 6 cars and a 5-ton grip truck in Marina del Rey, right where it connects to Venice, I can attest to the fact that moving cars around in that area is a full-time job. You can't like leave anything anywhere because you're always blocking somebody's house or an apartment building or something, and it's just no parking anywhere. Don't park there. Just don't even bother.
Don't go to Venice.
Don't have a car. Don't go to Venice. Don't go to Venice. Austin, no. Austin, what's his name, is there?
Yes, yes. Our dear friend who I met one time, who loves the Abbot Kinney area. For those listeners who are not aware, Abbot Kinney is the trendy, hip area that they started this thing called First Fridays, and it's like an arts thing, man. And like, it's all about the art, man, and like all the different like bars and shops and stuff they opened. And it was just like, wow, what a chill scene, bro. And then flash forward 5 years, and it's all like big chains, like what is it? Lucky Jeans is in there.
Don't they have an Urban Outfitters down there too?
Not an Urban Outfitters, but maybe like give it another year. Because it's been like completely gentrified into just like really expensive hipster stuff, which cracks me up. Because like there are all the stores where you walk in and they sell like 5 things, but they're all like $200, and you're like, how do you stay in business?
Like, it's just like Melrose.
Yeah, I mean that also like baffles me. Like I can't understand with like real estate prices with being what they are, but the sidewalks are always super gross. Watch where you step.
I was gonna say, does it smell any better down there these days?
It's not so much the smell as it is just like the ground is just like really gross. So it's just like you really cannot rely on just walking.
Yeah,
like
it's probably
one foot in front of the other.
all of the food trucks and the lack of trash cans around those food trucks.
Oh, there are trash cans, but they don't seem to empty them, because they are City of Los Angeles trash cans.
Oh, speaking of a City of Los Angeles trash can, back to Cobra.
Dang.
Yeah, see, that's funny. Yeah. It's a dig. I'm gonna put a poster of Cobra up next to my joke on Twitter or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what else happens in this movie. Not really anything.
No, there's so little that happens in here, and I mean the best non sequitur that's in here is of course the robot montage.
Oh yeah, the robot montage. Where he's, you know, it wouldn't be cheesy enough if it was just a montage of Stallone, like, going around all the seedy bars in Los Angeles and yanking bartenders across the bar by their shirt and questioning them, apparently, even though we can't hear what they're saying. But then it's intercut with, there's got to be, like, a minute of cuts of just these, like, 6-foot-tall robots before you even see Brigitte Nielsen, like, modeling next to them, because apparently she's a model.
Yeah, well, my favorite thing about that is they go from those gritty shots of him like busting up people and like taking things seriously to, like you said, just like assembled robots, just metal with like little nuts for eyes, you know, and like they look like ridiculous little robots, and the camera is just like on a Dutch angle and zooms in on them and then cuts away to something else. And you're just like, what is happening? It doesn't make any sense. Because at first, for like the first like 30 seconds, you're like, why are there robots in here? Is there like a robot takeover angle? Is that what the New World Order is? Like,
and that's the big one, because that montage is really long. But there's another moment later where it's like, the editor got bored and decided to like start cutting it to the beat, like it's a music video or something. It's very odd because the montage is not like traditional montage. It's like cut to the beat and like kind of dancey and really, really odd.
Yeah. Well, the editing in this is just like a garbage fire.
and of course, you've got David Rash there playing the photographer. Who apparently his name's Dan. I just noticed that. That's terrible. I love later where he walks Brigitte Nielsen to the car and in, you know, very casual terms, basically just says, like, I want to help you with your career, so you just need to sleep with me so I can help you do things. It's incredibly sleazy and completely pointless.
Well, the security guard who works the elevator, who lets them out of the elevator, he's like, you want me to walk with you to your car? And the sleazy guy turns around to the guard and he's like, no, I got this. And the guard's like, okay. And it's just like, dude, bro, like, you gotta be like, no, this guy is really scummy. Like, I will take care of this for this lady.
Although I gotta say, yeah, like all of the things, particularly in that scene, the violence of the night slasher folks is pretty gruesome. The smashing of the car into the elevator, killing the police security guard dude, mm-hmm. was pretty violent.
And also that was a rather unexpected, I should say. One of the nice things that I could say about this film was that they had the guy go up, find her purse, go back down to the garage to give him an excuse to show up there, so that he could hand it off to her. And they also like had a scene of him before anything bad happened, so that way you knew he was there and it wasn't just like a deus ex machina of some random security guard walking
security
in.
Security guard ex machina?
Yeah, exactly. And this way it sets it up nicely enough that, you know, when he shows back up and he's going to protect her, that you're like, oh, great, we've got a security guard, everything's fine. And then the van drives right into him. And there's a good cut of that, like when they smash him to itty bitty bits.
Yeah, and they plow right into the building and they really jack it up, so they committed to that for sure. That was probably expensive to do, but I also thought it was hilarious, the photographer sleazy Dan guy there, like they swung, what did they swing, an axe at him or something, and he like fell down between some pipes, so they like hit the pipes twice, but then he like stood back up to try and run and just gets an axe right in the chest. It's like, oh, that wasn't smart.
No, but whatever. It's really weird. I also like the angle of having the lady with some rather unfortunate hair working in the police department, so that she is actively working against the hero cop of the film.
Not super subtle.
No, it's not subtle at all. I like when they first introduce her and they have her pulling up the license plate, and they just, you know, have the shot of her back and forth with her and the computer screen. That's fine. But then they have the scene with her and Brian Thompson where she's like, let me kill the person for you. I'll do it to save you. You must never be taken away. Kissy, kissy, blah. Like that scene is just like, you guys, you lost it. Like, you could have had something there where she was committed to the cause. We still don't know what the cause is, whatever. But it could have been a cause. She could have been committed to the cause. But instead, it's just like she just has some sort of weird, like, I want to make out with Brian Thompson thing going on.
Yeah. Also, when they did decide to flee and go hide in the motels or whatever, they had that little stopover at the diner where he does his Fonzie thing against the jukebox to get it to play the record because it makes a screechy record. But she's over there in the corner talking on the phone, and I'm just like, is she the worst person, like the worst detective, like sneaking up on them because she's like in the same room with them? But then later he's like, he's talking to her and like, hey, you're doing a good job. Like, we're on the same team or whatever. Like, I never saw the part where she was in on the away team to go like hide Brigitte somewhere. So I just thought she was like trying to be discreet, hiding in the corner. But like Stallone was totally staring at her because she was eyeing them the entire time. And
yeah,
he was just like a bad guy that doesn't know how to like hide.
No, there was also another line with Gonzalez says that she's left her room. So she was there with them on purpose and they knew about it ahead of time. But it's not as coherently put together as one might expect with like a scene where they're like, the three of you are going out there.
Yeah. Was she riding with Gonzalez? Because like I didn't see the part where she left to go with them. She just like showed up in the middle of nowhere and was talking on payphones.
No, maybe that was her motorcycle. But yeah, it could have been better for integrating her into there, and then it would be like, oh, well, there that would be something positive I could say about the film, but I can't really. It didn't work. It didn't wind up fitting together right.
Yeah. It's a shame that like both the plot and story stuff in addition to the filmmaking was bad, because like I feel like you could have hid a lot of the bad story stuff here with some just like flashy filmmaking and 80s style whatever, you know, pop culture junk, but they didn't do any of that.
No, I have to disagree. I think they did try to hide it with flashy filmmaking. Hence,
just didn't know how to do it very well.
Yeah, because hence all the quick cutting and the extreme close-ups and insert shots that require planning. You know, so they weren't trying to like slouch on it. It's just that they did a bad job. Like somebody could try really hard, but if they do a bad job, it doesn't matter if they tried really hard. You know, like they didn't know how to execute this tastefully or in a way that could have had some humor about it, so that they could sort of poke fun at the seriousness of it. It's all deadly serious, and it's a zillion cuts of extreme close-ups of nothing important and insert shots that took forever to plan, and you're just like, why did you do all of this flashy stuff that doesn't amount to anything? Yeah.
I mean, you know, Stallone was really only in the biz for about 10 years before they decided to do this thing, so maybe he thought he could handle it and he had some crazy ideas, but he really just had no idea.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's bad. It's not even that it's just like flat out bad. There's just a giant lack of substance to this movie.
Yeah. Thompson repeatedly sought Stallone's advice about how to play Night Slasher, including questions about his background and personal motivations. But Stallone showed no interest in the subject and told Thompson that the character was simply evil. In an unfortunate surprise for Thompson, after filming was completed, director Cosmatos unexpectedly told him, "You could have been good if you had listened to me."
Oh dear. Because I guess he went to Stallone for the advice because Stallone wrote it and was curious about the background, but the director maybe had some practical advice.
I'm not even sure if the director offered him advice from the way that quote was framed. But sure, could have been.
Goodness.
Yeah.
All could it could have turned Brian Thompson's career around. He could have been the next Stallone, or I don't know, somebody.
But he was Shao Kahn, Dan.
not everybody can say that.
Have you ever seen Mortal Kombat Annihilation?
I have, but I haven't seen it since it was new. So
yeah, I only saw it in theaters. I was so excited because I loved the first movie. I was a child. I was not as discerning, but I loved the first movie, and I thought that the second movie would be just as great. It was not. It was, in fact, in many ways absolutely horrible and like one of the worst films you could put together off of a franchise.
Now I'm trying to think what actually happens in it. I don't know if I remember it. Maybe I didn't see it. Maybe Earth, I just retconned that.
Earth is invaded from Outworld, and the dimensions are colliding, and things are zip-zapping between places. Because reasons, and they had to recast a lot of the roles from the first ones because the actors and actresses did not want to come back. And so
I can't imagine why.
You know, I can't either. And they had a lot of effects and stuff and shouting and combat. Yep.
Oh my, the photo. Oh my goodness, the photos on IMDb. No, I did not see this. Wait. Maybe I did, because there's Cyrex. I remember Cyrex.
Yeah, because he was only in that one. He wasn't in the first one.
I feel like I saw something. I don't know if I saw all of this. I think I got drunk and tried to watch this on TV a number of years ago, but I didn't see all of it.
Well, good news, Dan. I think it's still on Netflix.
After our past three episodes, I was going to make a suggestion that we sort of like find this fluidity of connection between our films. We went to Beverly Hills Cop and then to Cobra because there was a theme, but maybe we should keep that up. Maybe we should move on to something that's related to Cobra, which might be Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
We can talk about this some more offline.
You know, you don't want to commit to it on the air.
No, I don't want to make any promises.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cobra. Man, he sure had that cool machine gun that made funny noises with that gigantic laser on the top.
That was so ridiculous. I like when he put he took the laser off and like put it on the thing, and then, you know, the bad guy was, you know,
he
thought
didn't even
the
laser
was
off. He just stuck the gun up in the pipe there. The guy could have just grabbed the gun and shot him with it.
Yeah, that was not smart. But
it was also great how he was like putting it together and like putting the mags in and racking it and putting bullets in it and making all kinds of noise. And then it goes over to Brigitte and she's looking at him. He's like, can't sleep, huh? I would have been like, yeah, you're making a bunch of racket with that stupid machine gun. Put it down.
Yeah. And, you know, it's sad, too, that they didn't have just like a fun little song number like G.I. Joe movie did for Cobra. You know,
there were some songs.
Evil Taking Flight Through the Darkest Night. Cobra. No, do you not remember? Did you ever watch the G.I. Joe movie?
The animated movie.
Yeah.
No.
Oh god, it's bad. But the opening to it is probably one of the most amazing 1980s cartoon moments you could watch. There is a musical invasion of the Statue of Liberty. With balloons and an aircraft carrier that flies, and it's astounding, really. Words can't do it justice.
Is it?
It's on YouTube. Yeah, so you should definitely watch it.
Okay, is it better than the live action G.I. Joes, which I also have not seen?
I haven't seen them either, so I'm sure they're not, because they were Stephen Sommers. So.
Wait, Stephen Sommers, what did he do?
Mummy.
Oh.
Van Helsing?
Did you see, somebody who just retweeted, they just finished shooting the Tom Cruise mummy.
Oh, great.
Principal photography on that one.
Yeah, well, did you see that Tom Cruise is in some sort of pay negotiation dealy over the next Mission Impossible, holding that up?
No, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
What are they going to have him climb onto or jump out of this time?
I don't know. But
he wants more money?
It does appear either he wants more money or he would like the same amount of money and is not being given that. I'm not sure exactly. I don't particularly care for Tom Cruise, as we've discussed before. But people love those Mission Impossible movies for reasons that escape me.
They're good movies. And, you know, you figure at this point, he's an actor. He's a great actor. It's what he does, and it's what he does well. He should just, I don't know that he really needs to think about money anymore. He's Tom Cruise. He's got a lot of money. So just, you know, some stuff.
Are you suggesting that he just cruise?
Just cruise on through the later years of life, man.
Mm-hmm.
There's only going to be so many more years where you can jump out of gigantic buildings in Dubai.
Yeah. Well, I'm just... Well, what was the last... I think the last Mission Impossible that I watched was 3.
Oh, well, 4 and 5 are great. 4 is really good.
Okay.
5 I've only seen once, but I remember enjoying it.
I really hated 2.
John Woo. I just watched that again on TV not too long ago. It's so John Woo-y, it's insane. You remember, like, we used to make fun of John Woo, you know, the doves and the slow-mo and stuff, but like, I think it's gone so far out of fashion that it's come back into fashion. Like, do you remember the Limp Bizkit theme song that they did for that movie?
I can't even recall it.
Limp Bizkit redid the Mission Impossible theme song. You know, there's the opening scene. Like, all of this is, like, filtered through pop culture in my brain because, like, in the MTV Video Music Awards, they parodied the part in the opening of the movie where he's climbing up the mountain, you know, doing his free climbing, rock climbing thing, and he's hanging backwards there. Wasn't it, like, Jimmy Fallon or some crap who was hosting the awards, and he did, like a mock Tom Cruise thing, and there's the Oakley glasses that he wears to get his little mission report, and he throws them in slow motion, and they explode in the middle of the air. Like, it's so... cheesy, like, 90s action movie that it's almost awesome to watch again now.
And wasn't there the motorcycle fight where they're, like, going at each other in slow-mo with the motorcycles and stuff?
There's so much motorcycle stuff.
Oh, God.
There's so much motorcycle. It's so great. You have to watch. And it's long-hair Tom Cruise, too, when it's, like, down the back of his neck.
No.
I remember when I watched it in the theater, I was like, oh, come on. They're doing the face mask peel-off thing too many times. But now you look at it, it's like, oh, my God, they did the face mask thing again. It's so bad, it's good now. And I miss John Woo's directing style. It's so like in your face that it's just like it's a breath of fresh air compared to all the nonsense going on these days.
I guess
we might have to do it because I think it's on Netflix as well, but like it's on HBO Go or one of the like Showtime Now things or whatever, but it's man, it is some nostalgia. It's good. It's good.
Okay.
It's good. It's that era where the 90s action movie was like starting to get out of its awkward teenage phase, because the 90s, like, you know, the late 90s and early 2000s were all just like awkward teenager phase. Like, pop culture was disgusting. Like, if you look at all of the, you know, NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, like all of the stuff circling around that is just so embarrassing to look back at now. But
Backstreet's back.
Sure. Right. I mean, their cameo at the end of This Is the End is pretty great. I hope you've seen that movie. I didn't just ruin anything for you.
I haven't seen it, but I wasn't going to.
Oh, it's the best like ending of any movie ever.
I'm Seth Rogen and James Franco
making fun of themselves, though.
But still, them combined.
You gotta see it. It's entertaining.
I watched The Interview.
No, it's a thousand times better than that.
Because I was like, you know, I hope this hack was worth it, because I'm sure this will be some incisive commentary on North Korea, and God, that was awful and terrible, and I have this feeling that maybe, perhaps, they have been given too much money to do whatever they want, and no oversight.
I think This Is the End was right before that or something, wasn't it? But
yeah, it was before that, but it didn't make me want to go back and watch it. And then on top of that, the recent performance of the sausage party movie. God.
Yeah.
No, thank you. I mean,
see, you should watch This Is the End. It's actually amusing. If for nothing else, a lot of celebrities are killed in hilarious ways. But
I think I'll just watch more Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, you know, whatever makes you feel good.
Mm-hmm. Star Trek. Star Trek makes me feel good, Dan.
Well, then I'm not going to try and dissuade you from watching Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you should watch Mission Impossible 2 again. Just revel in the hilarity of the nostalgia. But the fourth and fifth ones are good. The fifth one's more of like a James Bond style movie, but the fourth one's really good.
Okay. Will you do me a favor?
Maybe.
And volunteer to be back on Random Trek again?
Oh, of course.
Okay, well, go get in touch with the peoples.
I don't think he's really starving for guests. He just had
Max Temkin.
Yeah, so yeah. I think he's got plenty of people. I'm sure.
Well, you know, I'm a tough act to follow, so you gotta start the starting over again.
He's probably gonna be Max Temkin, and then he's gonna get John Roderick, and then and maybe he'll get Merlin again, and then I'll go right in after those guys.
Oh,
and
good.
Disappoint everybody.
Well, that's what you wanna do. You gotta build it back up, and then you gotta take it back down again. You can't leave things up there too long, because then people will be like, oh, this show has nowhere to go up but up, and then
yeah.
It's like you can't fulfill that, really.
You got to get the really high highs immediately followed by the really low lows.
Yeah. You can't have the light without the darkness, you know.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
That's from Star Trek.
No. But yeah, there we go. That is the end of this.
Yeah.
Speaking of the end. This is the end. LOL.
This is where the podcast ends and we begin.
Mm-hmm. This is the podcast and we're the cure.
Oh, so many terrible metaphors.
No, should just end with a Robert Smith song there. Just
ugh.
Get it, the Cure.
Oh yeah, like that band, the guy with the hair.
Yes, and the lipstick.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, podcast
over.